corrections. For the next 2 days, we will be hearing public testimony. And to try to accommodate those of you who have come from some distance, we would like to hear from you first and recognize many of you who have taken time off from work to be here, and we appreciate that very much. And I'm going to get some signals, I think, from those who have helped organize your coming here today, and so that we make sure we accommodate, again, those who have come from some distance. I would simply ask that those who are regularly in this building, if it makes sense in our presentation for you to present your remarks tomorrow, that would be great, or if we happen to have time today. One additional complication, the House is convening today at 10 a.m., so that shortened our time a bit. And we will do our best to
speaking of the House,
hopefully limit our perhaps limit our questioning, but to the extent that we can give succinct answers to whatever questions we have, that would be helpful in accommodating all that have come to provide information. So with that, and I think many of you were advised that a approximate testimony of about 5 minutes would be great. If, again, there's a way in the interest of the unfortunate fact the House is departing at 10 to condense that down to maybe a three-minute slice and one that is not repetitive, that would also be helpful. And I apologize for having to say that. Frankly, many of us, I'm sure, would tell you that we really appreciate private citizens who are not regularly in this building coming here and telling us your stories. That is among the most valuable testimony that we receive, and we mean that. So, sorry about the restrictions. So, I better be quiet so you can talk. And I'd ask that, and if I call some names and there's a different order in which you want to appear, you come up with your panels that whatever have been selected. But the first one on the list here is it Bridget? Am I messing up?
I'm from Portland. I'm Bridget, and I was just wondering if you wanted to start with the people who came from a further distance.
All right.
Can we do the other list with the folks who are from way out?
Well, you're way out, but you're here all the time.
Geographically speaking, Mr.
Would this be Mr. Merrill? Coos Bay? Great place. And Mr. Moore from Ontario? Mr. Wally? Wallery? Woolery, excuse me.
Most of the time we're way out too, so don't
yes.
worry about it.
I'm sure we'll put that on display. Welcome to you all, and if you would, before you give your testimony, identify yourself with your name and then proceed with your testimony, we'd appreciate it. Thank you again for being here.
I'm John Merrill. Actually, I'm from Coquille, which is pretty close to Coos Bay. I work at Shutter Creek Correctional Institution as a correctional counselor. 25-year resident of Oregon, which almost makes me a native Oregonian, I think. I've spent over half my life here. Worked for the state of Oregon for 25 years now. I've worked for the Department of Corrections for the last 6 years. Okay. As you hear about the proposed budget for the Department of Corrections, you'll be told many things. Some will be true, some may be possible, and some's going to be pure spin. I'll leave it to your wisdom to determine what's what. The Oregon Department of Corrections is faced with a growing population of inmates, housing an increasing number of institutions spread across an expanding area of the state of Oregon. They've been asked to maintain this growth with the accompanying costs of infrastructure and increased staffing at the same time that Oregon faces a serious budget shortfall. Faced with this, the administration has developed a plan within which they hope to continue providing the minimum level of necessary services while complying with the directives of the governor and his budget. In my opinion, their plan is seriously flawed. It ignores sound correctional practices and basic human nature. If put in place without major modifications, it will greatly increase the likelihood of disturbances in our institutions. It will fail to fulfill the department's mission to decrease the chance of recidivism. It will directly endanger those within the institutions, both staff and inmates, and indirectly it will endanger the public. Warden Dennis Luther of the Federal Correctional Institution McKean in Bradford, Pennsylvania, authored a list of 28 beliefs about the treatment of inmates, any of which, if they were violated, threatened the safety and security of the institution and the staff that worked there. These beliefs can be found posted on the walls of several of our institutions in Oregon. I would like to quote some of them. Number 5 states, and I quote, "Normalize the environment to the extent possible by providing programs, amenities, and services. The denial of such must be related to maintaining order and security rather than punishment." Number 14 states, "There is inherent value in self-improvement programs, such as education, whether or not these programs are related to recidivism." Number 15 states, "Inmates need legitimate opportunities to enhance their self-esteem." The Department of Corrections has engaged in massive cuts in inmate programming and proposes still more. At Snake River Correctional Institution, the entire education department has been disbanded. Just Monday of this week, 2 days ago, the education department at Shutter Creek Correctional Institution received their pink slips. The STEP program at Sandingham Correctional Institution has been cut. The contract with Pathfinders has been reduced by half. Recreational specialists across the state are or will be laid off or reassigned. The Oregon Summit program, unique in the breadth of inmate programming that is provided, is being gutted, both in structure and in content. I am told that the medical department is actually counting Band-Aids, and basic needs such as aspirin are no longer available to the inmates. I'm dismayed as I look at the staffing and program cuts within the department. In some settings, there are as many as one manager for every 5 employees, and yet it is the frontline workers who watch as their jobs are eliminated. The end result will be idled inmates, supervised by fewer staff. Be assured, these inmates will find a way to fill their time. It will be through the expression of their boredom, frustration, and resentment. Now, the department will tell you they have a plan. They propose to move inmates through a graduated system of programs aimed at preparing them for their eventual release into our communities. Through economy of scale and localization of resources, greater efficiencies will be attained. What they won't tell you is that the current level of programming does not meet the needs of the current inmate population. As a counselor making referrals, I have seen waiting lists of 200 inmates waiting to get into alcohol and drug programs. I've had men come to me practically begging for anger treatment that the Department of Corrections doesn't even provide, or at that time didn't provide. I watch every day as people are released into our communities that lack basic skills in things like how to make a budget, how to interview for a job, or even how to form a friendship. Their way of forming a friendship is to walk up to somebody and say, "Do you want to smoke a joint?" Yet we're to believe that a reduction in program options accompanied by massive transportation of inmates across thousands of square miles will lead to improvements in a system that already fails to meet its stated objective. No, we will instead see the same developments that have occurred at Snake River Correctional Institution. There'll be no morning yard outs, insufficient work, and few programming options that lead to restless inmates, which predictably erupt into institutional disturbances all too frequently. We will see inadequate staff forced to work mandatory overtime, creating family disruptions and leading to burnout, inefficient workers. The Department of Correction certainly needs to reduce its operating expenses. My son would appreciate it. He's a learning disabled student in Coquille School. If the funds for Department of Corrections are effectively reduced, maybe they'll have the money to fix the roof that leaks in his resource room. The question I leave you with today is this: has the administration of the Department of Corrections identified the best ways to increase efficiency while fulfilling their mission and purpose? A fruit tree will produce many suckers among its producing branches. They will affect the health and productivity of the entire tree. A wise gardener will trim those suckers of the branches from the top before cutting into the basic structure of an otherwise healthy tree. Thank you.
Thank you. Proceed with your testimony.
In the interest of time, I'd like to just pass this out. I think that he spoke eloquently about that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I was asked today to come, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, to testify with the Measure 17 program and its impact that some of these cuts are going to have. I sit before you today somewhat perplexed by all the statistics and information generated by this important process.
Would you please identify yourself? I'm sorry.
My name's Tim Woolery. Tim Woolery, correctional officer.
Thank you, Tim.
Appreciate it. My colleagues and I are certain of is that the reductions in line staff positions and programs across the state will have the potential for dire consequences. Staff members with considerably more time than I in the system cite the riots of the 1960s resulting from the cuts in programs at that time as an ever-increasing possibility. Experience has taught us that idle inmates do not equate to idle criminal minds. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, my name is Jim Moore. I work at Snake River Correctional Facility. I've been with the Department of Corrections for 9 years, 9 months, and 22 days. Who's counting? Still got a while to go to get to retirement. But what it looks like to me is with the cuts and the budgets for DOC's people, I may get an early retirement like some of our staff have gotten through workers' compensation. We're getting people all but killed on the front lines. And the inmates themselves will tell you that the reason this is happening is because of the cuts and the budgets. They've lost their education. They're losing their morning yard periods. By the way, we're going to have a yard officer, so I hear this on a daily basis. Every day I'm out in the yard. There's been numerous threats towards staff because they blame the line staff for what's happening to them. Because it's like anybody else, they strike out at who they can get a hold of. And it's not management, and it's not people working the budget. It's us. And our lives are on the line. We don't like it. We think the inmates deserve a little more than just basic absolute needs, which is food and water and shelter. They need to have their programming. They need to have exercise times. They need to have those periods that they can burn off their frustrations. They need something to work towards, something to accomplish, and they're not doing that at this time. They have nothing to look forward to. They sit in a cell 8 hours a day, sometimes 24 hours a day, just contemplating what they can do to make the system help them. And the only way that they've learned that the system will help them is to strike out, and to strike out at staff. We've had stabbings. We've had officers assaulted with locks and a sock. We've had numerous things happen. We have what they call a hit list, is who the officers or who the managers or who the sergeants or whatever it is that they want to go after. They think will get them the most. The budgets need to be put back in place. They need to have education programs. I'd rather see an inmate go to class and sit there with 40 or 50 of them in a classroom behaving themselves than it would to see these people sitting idle thinking that what they can do is come after people. We have management staff, which is way overmanaged. We can identify with the governor's proposal around 24 management positions in the institution. And just by going through a quick analysis, we've come up with 57. That's quite a bit. That's about 33 overstaffed as far as management goes. And that's a lot of money. That's money that can be put back into the programmings, back into the line staff, and back into inmates' help. They need it, and we should get it for them. We can't keep telling these people that they're not entitled to anything. Thank you.
Question.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had some discussions yesterday about trying to restore morning yard program or yard program, and I guess I just appreciate your perspective about how critical you think that is in terms of the other programs, i.e. the education or treatment programs or work programs, whether you see morning yard or yard is the most important or the, you know, important or the least important, and why.
Well, Senator Brown, I would think that the morning yard period would set right up amongst number one.
Could you talk to me about why that might be?
We have more participants going to the yard, and they go out and burn off frustrations. Cutting the yards essentially has taken one person off of each of the three complexes at Snake River. So that's a savings of three job positions that you can add back in and give 250 to 400 inmates access to yard periods. So whether the three job positions, and when you cut those three job positions, those three staff members are no longer working in the chow hall during chow time. So the safety factor for the entire institution becomes much greater. Okay. We need those personnel, and we need them back on the floor. So if we start taking people away, pretty soon the inmates will understand where we're losing our people at, and they will understand where they can go and what they need to do to create havoc. It's very easy for them.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you all for your testimony. One thing I would ask you on the recommendations you've made here, or the talk about maybe it's a little heavy in the management end, have you prepared anything formal that we could review, a way to restructure?
Well, I haven't prepared anything for restructuring, but I do have the facts and figures and you know, in the paperwork that shows where the positions are.
Could you provide that to this committee?
Yes, I can.
You will? Okay. Yes. We appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thank you for coming.
Can I
yes.
speak to that question?
Sure.
Just like I think I can speak with it anecdotally, at least, with Shutter Creek. We have quite a few managers down there. When I did the figures, it came out better to 1 to 5. The official figures show it, I think, around 1 to 7, one manager for every 7 employees. When the need for position cuts was announced, even with all that management staff, the decision was to cut 5 line staff positions. I have gone, in my role as union president of our chapter there, and I've tried to negotiate with administration about this and coming up with other ideas, not just to save jobs, but maybe to reclassify some positions and such. Even now, and we have a lieutenant who's going to be leaving, I suggested, he got promoted to a captain at Coffee Creek, I suggested that they eliminate that captain or lieutenant position, because they have 3 day shift lieutenants. I'm not sure what they do. I thought they could combine the duties of those three. They're laying off 2 counselors, a food service worker, and cutting 2 officers' positions. I suggested they could eliminate that lieutenant's position, downgrade one of the counselor positions to a program representative, who would then be responsible for the programming that the counselors are currently doing in terms of teaching all the classes, eliminate the other counselor position, which would be mine, coincidentally, in fact save money and still meet the required reductions in staff. And frankly, I felt like I was talking to a brick wall when I brought up this possibility. It's like that management structure is invulnerable to the cuts from these budget reductions. That's my impression anyway.
So at most you received just a no, or did you get any?
What I was
no
told
a
was that I was told I was experienced as a naysayer, that I had a single track mind, and that I kept telling them how their plan wouldn't work rather than working with them in order to make it work. That's what I was told.
Well, that's good information. I assume it'll be forthcoming to this committee in a formal presentation, and we appreciate it. Thank you very much. All right. Is it Tina Marfitt? No, she's not here. Go back to
the original list you were starting with.
The original list. Bridget.
You can do 3 if you want.
And Jack Moran. Tate, Karen Campbell,
so you got the first 3 then.
I did. Thank you. Please identify yourself for our record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Bridget Sarabi, and I'm a spokesperson for the Oregon Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. Amy Claire is passing out some things here. We have, first of all, the testimony that I'm going to give you today. Also, as many of you are aware, we did have a community forum on the prison programs on April 5th in Portland. I know there were many conflicts down here in Salem, and some of you weren't able to join us. We have the signatures of over 100 people who signed a sheet saying they'd like to preserve the programs. We're passing that out. And we also have written testimony from over 30 people who came to the community forum that we promised them we would deliver their testimony here today. I'm here today to urge you to preserve funding for inmate activities, morning yard, prison-based education and treatment programs, and health care and mental health that have been proposed for elimination. After review of the fiscal analysis of the governor's recommended public safety budget, I believe that many of these programs can be maintained by cutting other costs within the department. I look to you as members of the public safety subcommittee to assure that the department uses our tax dollars wisely and promotes broader public safety through responsible budget allocations that maintain programs that reduce recidivism. I've spent over 20 years working for nonprofit agencies where my duties included raising, managing, and allocating funds up to $3 million a year. So I'm not a complete novice at institutional or budget management. My review of the department's budget leads me to the following broad conclusions. The latest inmate population projections that the budget is based on may be inflated. The department has made costly assumptions of the type of facilities, beds, and staffing needed, assumptions that are clearly contrary to the department's own inmate population profile and projections. There are potential cost savings outlined in several areas that do not appear to be reflected in the budget. Decisions on capital financing mechanisms have been made and are being proposed that may be unnecessarily costly. And finally, increased funding is being proposed for programs that are not fulfilling their primary mission, have misallocated funds, and have failed to be accountable to the legislature and the people of Oregon. I realize that I've raised some very serious concerns, and I ask your patience as I outline them in a little more detail. All of the things that I will be referring to are contained within the legislative fiscal analysis of the governor's budget. I take all my information right from there. In terms of my first point, this budget is based on inmate population projections made by the department in October 2000 and revised in April 2001. In the original October figures, the department states that the forecast was revised upward during the 2001-2003 biennium from the prior forecasts. I'm not a gambler, however, I'm willing to wager that in the coming year, after the budget is passed, those forecasts will go down. And I make this assertion based on the experience of some of our neighboring states. For example, in 1997, the Montana Department of Corrections asked the Montana legislature for $103 million in new funds, including $50 million to build additional prison cells. The justification for this increase was a significant jump in the inmate population forecast prepared by the Montana Department of Corrections. The day after the Montana governor signed off on the construction of a new prison, the Department of Corrections reported that prison growth had slowed and incarceration projections for 2000 were down by half what was expected. In 99, the same thing happened, but in Montana that year, the legislature said, "We don't think so," and they did not give the department the huge increase they were asking for. In Utah in 1998, inmate population forecasts spurred the legislature to appropriate seed funding for site evaluation for a new 500 to 1,000 bed prison. But by October 99, the Utah Department of Corrections reported a marked decline in both crime statistics and projected inmate population growth. Fortunately, the Utah legislature was able to make the decision to cancel plans for the now unneeded prison. Finally, in California over the past few years, we first saw a bond measure to build a new 5,000-bed prison overwhelmingly defeated by voters. But based once again on increasing inmate population projections, the state allocated money for the general fund.